Good evening. This is the KRFP Evening Report for Wednesday, July 11th, 2012. I'm Lee Robartis in the news tonight. Spokesman Review newspaper must turn over information to help identify anonymous blog commenter. Western Organization of Resource Councils warns of 10 times increase in coal train traffic in the Northwest, and Giant Palouse Earthworm Hike on Paradise Ridge focuses on rare native Palouse habitat. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Report, but first, world headlines from Feature Story News, Free Speech Radio News, and the Pacifica Radio Network. And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. Some of the numerous wildfires in southern Idaho are threatening homes. The Boise County Sheriff's Department ordered residents near the Aveline Fire in the Boise National Forest to evacuate. So far, the fire has hit 250 acres, but it is only 50% contained. There are at least 7 new lightning-caused fires burning within the last 24 hours between Twin Falls and Malta. The Bureau of Land Management reported the Kenyon Road Fire, which is Idaho's largest, is now 75% contained. That fire has burned 340 square miles of grass and sagebrush in south-central Idaho. Yesterday, a portion of Interstate 84 in southwestern Idaho was closed after a rollover accident set nearby grass on fire. Meanwhile, in Montana, a cluster of fires called the Ash Creek Complex has also been brought mostly under control, while high temperatures, strong winds, and the possibility of dry lightning keep the fire danger in the inland Northwest very high. The Western Organization of Resource Councils said in a report released today, a plan to ship eastern Montana coal to Asia could lead to more than 10 times the number of coal trains moving through the Northwest as there are now. The organization says the shipments by several coal companies could result in 60 coal trains per day running through Billings, Sandpoint, and Spokane, with smaller coal train increases in Seattle and Portland. Terry Whiteside, one of the report's authors, said, "Make no mistake about it, this is a huge, huge increase in volume like we've never seen before in this part of the world." Report co-author Gerald Fouth says the shipments from the Powder River Basin of eastern Montana and northern Wyoming will mostly benefit the Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad, owned by billionaire Warren Buffett. The company owns the shortest route to the coast and has the most competitive hauling prices. Other railroads that would haul the coal are Union Pacific and Montana Rail Link. Fouth and Whiteside warn of severe impacts on local communities, including the health impacts of coal dust flying off the trains, which are usually more than 100 cars long. They also say the trains will impact emergency services and economic activity by forcing vehicles to wait at crossings. Opponents to the shipments are also pointing out the global impacts of burning more coal in Asia, adding to the Earth's climate problems. Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railway spokesperson Suanne Lundsberg says the Western Organization of Resource Council's report assumed all the coal shipment plans to 6 different Northwest ports will be approved. Lundsberg said, "They're assuming all of them will be built and all of them will be operating at full capacity and will be traveling on one railroad. That's just not realistic." Lundsberg says the railroad is capable of spending the millions of dollars in improvements to their tracks and infrastructure needed to meet the demand for more coal transport to the coast. District Court Judge John Luster in Coeur d'Alene ruled yesterday the Spokesman Review must turn over information that could lead to the identity of an anonymous poster on the newspaper's Huckleberry's blog, who made a disparaging comment about Kootenai County Republican Party Chair Tina Jacobson. The commenter who went by the online name Almost Innocent Bystander, wrote under a blog picture of Jacobson that $10,000 reported missing from the Kootenai County Republican Party Central Committee's funds may be, quote, stuffed inside Tina's blouse. Jacobson sued, seeking information on the identity of Almost Innocent Bystander and two others who commented on Almost Innocent Bystander's post. Those commentators went by the names Phaedrus and Out of State Tater. Judge Luster ruled the newspaper does not have to help identify those two. Luster wrote of the comment by Almost Innocent Bystander, while the individuals are entitled to the right of anonymous free speech, this right is clearly limited when abused. He wrote the other two commentators, Phaedrus and Out of State Tater, did not abuse their free speech rights by, quote, making defamatory comments. Luster ordered the spokesman review to hand to Jacobson, quote, any document establishing the identity, email address, and IP addresses of Almost Innocent Bystander. Jacobson's attorney, C. Matthew Anderson, said the ruling is a reaffirmation of the historically long-standing legal rule that there is no constitutional protection for a defaming statement. The interesting twist in this is the application of that legal rule to an anonymous internet commenter. That is the part that is refreshing. Spokesman Review editor Gary Graham said the newspaper has not yet decided if it will appeal Luster's decision, but said he is glad the judge did not require that they provide information about the two people who simply commented on the original posting. Spokesman Review attorney Dwayne Swinton had argued the blog site is a place, quote, where people express opinions, sometimes airing outrageous views. The administrator of the Huckleberry's online blog, Spokesman Review columnist Dave Oliveira, had removed the three comments 2.5 hours after Almost Innocent Bystander's first comment appeared. Judge Luster wrote that Oliveira was not acting as a journalist while overseeing the online blog, but rather acting as a, quote, facilitator of commentary and administrator of the blog. Luster said there was no indication the information was to be used in a news story or an editorial. Yesterday's earthworm hike on Paradise Ridge focused on what is likely the rare giant Palouse earthworm's habitat, native Palouse Prairie. The 23 hikers visited the southwest side of Paradise Ridge, home of the largest remnant of native Palouse Prairie habitat. Recent discoveries of likely specimens on Paradise Ridge, which were turned over to the University of Idaho, have raised hopes of finally learning more about this extremely rare native North American earthworm. Entomologist Tim Hatton with the Palouse Group Sierra Club said the Palouse Prairie habitat can come back with hard work, but native prairie restoration efforts here are nowhere near as advanced as they are in the Midwest.
I've been to prairie conferences back in the Midwest where the science is much further along than here and where there's a large germplasm in place. And they're restoring large tracts of prairie, just kind of farmer style. They'll go out and they'll just hit the ground for several years in a row with herbicides, and then they'll plant plugs right into that. And within a number of years, it's pretty amazing to see the prairie coming back. So it is possible, and that is what it's going to take. Right now, there's less than probably anywhere from 1 to 4% of the Palouse Prairie is left. That's it. 1 to 4%. And this, you're standing on probably the largest piece of prairie remnant in the area right here. And this is about 350 acres. And if you look out here, this is Bald Butte over here, and there's a complex of prairie remnants on Bald Butte over here. And then if you look out over this direction, this little nondescript hill out over there where you got the massive nuclear thunderhead cloud over it is Smoot Hill, and there's several very nice prairie remnants on Smoot Hill. And then we're looking at Tamiac Butte right there. Some good prairie on it. And back behind it is Steptoe, some good prairie on it. And then back around to Paradise. And then what you can't see is just back off over here is Tomar Butte. And there's a series of smaller buttes going off the back where there's a number of prairie remnants. And just the thought of connecting these remnants and trying to create connectivity so that the pollinators can move back and forth and move germplasm and keep these plant populations thriving is what we need to move to, and it's possible.
That was entomologist Tim Hatton of the Palouse Group Sierra Club, Palouse Prairie Foundation President David Hall, and Palouse Land Trust Executive Director Amy Trujillo said their groups are making efforts to protect and expand the native Palouse habitat, which is an ecologically diverse mixture of grasses interspersed with forbs and pockets of shrubs and conifers. Here's Hall, followed by Trujillo.
We have web pages out there with plant database of the native plants and suggestions of how to go about propagation. We don't really want people going out, especially if it's not your property, collecting seeds unless you really know what you're doing. So come to us if you want to try to get some plants going. We can educate people about how to do that responsibly. And we were consulted for the wind turbine project out of near Rosalia, and checked to see what prairie areas there were. Some native prairie up there, and tried to make sure that they didn't place their towers on any of the prairie to directly affect it. And eventually, we'll be allowed supposedly to go see what they've done. We haven't gotten up there since they've started moving earth, I don't think, but they say that they've kept away from the prairie, and they've put some money out for reserve for mitigation for if they do. So
we use conservation easements, so we basically tailor an agreement with the landowner as far as what they would like to conserve on their land, and they place certain restrictions on it that are upheld in perpetuity. So we have them come up with that agreement and then we come back every year and we monitor their property to make sure that the terms are being upheld.
That was Palouse Land Trust Director Amy Trujillo, preceded by Palouse Prairie Foundation President David Hall. As for the giant Palouse earthworms themselves, UI researchers are studying the recently found Paradise Ridge specimens and comparing them to worm specimens found near Leavenworth, Washington, to find out if they're the same species. At issue is Endangered Species Act designation. The giant Palouse earthworm had not been seen in nearly a century when several specimens were collected by University of Idaho scientist James Johnson in a second growth forest area between the city of Moscow and Moscow Mountain, about 7 miles away from Paradise Ridge, in 1986 or 1987. One report says there were 5 worms found, and 2 or 3 of the worms were taken and killed for identification. Unlike most earthworms found on this continent, the giant Palouse earthworm is native to North America. It's larger than most earthworms, seems to produce slime out of its mouth, and has its reproductive organs, or clitellum, located near the head instead of in the middle of its body. In 2005, University of Idaho graduate student Yaniria Sanchez de Leon killed a giant Palouse earthworm while digging near Albion, Washington. Then, in 2010, research support scientist Carl Umaker and University of Idaho student Shan Shu discovered 3 live specimens in a remnant of native Palouse prairie habitat on Paradise Ridge. Shortly after those specimens were found, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals affirmed a lower court ruling against local environmental groups who had petitioned the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to list the giant Palouse earthworm under the Endangered Species Act. The Fish and Wildlife Service declined to list the giant Palouse earthworm, citing the existence of likely specimens found on the east slopes of the Cascades and an inability to determine how many actually exist. This year's specimens may begin to answer questions about an animal scientists currently know very little about. Chris Bowers is a doctoral student with the Integrative Graduate Education and Research Traineeship Program of the National Science Foundation. Bauer is working with the University of Idaho soil scientist Jody Johnson Maynard, who is considered a regional expert on the giant Palouse earthworm.
She's been doing a lot of the work along with the U.S. and Fish and Wildlife to find out the extent of giant Palouse earthworm and some of its biology. We're doing some genetic work to find out if the Washington specimens are the same as the Idaho specimens. We're trying to develop a method for non-invasive detection using just little cotton swabs so we don't have to disturb the earthworm. It is a rare animal. We just want to know where it is.
And that's cotton swabs down into the earthworm burrows.
Exactly, yeah. Well, I'm hoping it works out.
All right.
That was doctoral student Chris Bowers. Yesterday's hike on Paradise Ridge was sponsored by the Palouse Group Sierra Club and Friends of the Clearwater, but the host at the bottom of the trail was Radio Free Moscow board member Cass Davis, who lives on Paradise Ridge and discovered a likely giant Palouse earthworm while hiking near his home in April. Later in May, Joseph Soss found a specimen that is still alive at the University of Idaho laboratories near the same spot where Davis found his giant Palouse earthworm. Here, KRFP citizen journalist Helen Yost speaks with Davis after the hike yesterday.
So you hosted this hike up to Paradise Ridge tonight, and tell us a little bit more about your and perhaps one of your associates' finds of rare Palouse earthworms up on the ridge?
Well, yeah, we found them and we're really pleased to see that they're there, and now we want to establish some sort of pattern so we can figure out how to study them. I mean, the scientists want to study them, and we've actually made some progress on this meeting. I talked to the earthworm guy from the U of I, and we might be setting up some sample places up behind the house to actually set up, like, cameras to look and see if they're coming out of burrow holes and stuff up behind the house. And I'm real interested in that. Sounds really fun. Sounds like, you know, because I live right here, I can monitor them and I can work with the U of I to do that. That sounds really good to me. And, of course, my ultimate goal would, I would like to see the Palouse earthworm protected. And I'd like to see the highway stopped from coming over the ridge with that protection. So
that was Paradise Ridge resident Cass Davis. You're listening to the KRFP Evening Report. This is KRFP Moscow. The Moscow Saturday Farmers Market will return to its former Jackson Street location this coming Saturday as the City Council and the Moscow Arts Commission continue to weigh whether a permanent move to Main Street would be a positive step for the market. The Arts Commission held a public input session on the possible move yesterday with mixed reactions from business owners, some saying the added pedestrian traffic on Main Street brings more people to their businesses, while others say the crowds block access to their stores. Lilliput Maternity and Children's Boutique owner Angela Grant said her business has been down 8% since the Saturday Farmers Market moved to Main Street on a temporary basis 4 weeks ago. Grant said the whole sides of the street are lined with vendor booths and tents. We fear the limiting our access and visibility may have long-term effects on our business and sales. Wine Company of Moscow owner Dennis Baird, on the other hand, noticed an uptick in customers since the farmers market moved to within half a block of his 3rd Street store. Baird said, "I see no problems keeping the market permanently on Main Street. I hope the city will decide to retain the change." The city council will consider a possible permanent move to Main Street at next Monday's meeting on July 16th, beginning at 7 p.m. at City Hall. The Pullman City Council listened to a report from Police Chief Gary Jenkins on a money-saving plan that would require citizens to report certain crimes online instead of having a police officer come to their homes. At present, Pullman residents have an option to report low-level crimes like car break-ins online, but making it a requirement could make citizens feel unsafe and dissatisfied with police services. The council is looking for ways to trim $500,000 from its budget and will also put fire and emergency services under scrutiny for budget cuts. After the budget process wraps up on Tuesday, July 31st, a public comment period will open and a public hearing and council action on the budget is scheduled to take place Tuesday, August 14th. Secretary of State Ben Assersa is reminding both Democratic and Republican candidates for the Idaho legislature that Idaho's official seal is for state business only and not an image to be used to legitimize their political campaigns. Republicans criticized three Democrats, including State Senator Elliot Work of Boise, Representative Sue Chu of Boise, and House candidate John Gannon, also of Boise, who used the seal on materials sent to voters which highlighted Republican ethics violations. Republican Senator Mitch Toriansky of Boise has removed the Idaho seal from his campaign's website following a complaint by his election opponent, former Democratic Representative Brandon Durst. We have more details on the Occupy Boise and American Civil Liberties Union of Idaho lawsuit filed in federal court in Boise Monday, which claims a new set of rules by the Idaho Department of Administration for protests and rallies near the state capitol violate the average citizen's right to free speech and assembly. The rules define a rally as two or more people, which an ACLU spokesperson said inhibits the ability of ordinary citizens to peacefully give their opinion on political issues. The ACLU also said the requirement of 5 days advance notice ahead of any political rally on the Capitol steps obstructs the public's ability to respond to the activity of the legislature in a timely manner, and that the requirement that all rallies end by 6 p.m. is also unnecessarily restrictive. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Take a look at the weather. Mostly clear tonight with a low of 56, sunny and a high of 93 tomorrow. Partly cloudy, low 61 Thursday night, mostly sunny, high 89 on Friday, and then a 20% chance of showers and thunderstorms after midnight Friday night and again on Saturday. Otherwise, partly cloudy and then mostly sunny on Saturday, low 64, high 89, 40% chance of showers and thunderstorms Saturday night and again on Sunday. Otherwise, mostly cloudy Saturday night, low 60 and partly sunny on Sunday, high 86. Currently at the Moscow Pullman Regional Airport, it is 86 degrees. Thanks for tuning in to the KRFP Evening Report. Coming up next is Building Bridges, your weekly labor report from Pacifica Radio, followed by Flashpoints, the daily investigative news magazine from Pacifica Radio. I'm Lee Robartis. Nancy Casey assisted with tonight's newscast. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscast during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on Radio Free Moscow, be sure to become a member of Radio Free Moscow. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students. You can mail your memberships to 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. That's Radio Free Moscow, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843, or you can go to the Radio Free Moscow website, krfp.org, or radiofreemoscow.com to find out more ways to help Radio Free Moscow. I'm Lee Robartis. This is KRFP Moscow. Stand by for more.